Hey guys, you're listening to the most captivating podcast in iTunes. That's right, the Elite Man Podcast, where we turn average men into elite men every day. We interview the very best experts from the lifestyle, health, fitness, social, and even entrepreneurial worlds. And with their help, we give you some of the best advice on the planet. Subscribe now if you haven't already and enjoy the show. And oh yeah, if you really enjoy it, leave us a review. On today's episode, episode number 144, entitled How to Master Your Mind and Take Charge of Your Life, I chat with Dr. Michael Gervais. Dr. Michael Gervais is a high-performance psychologist who regularly works with elite world-class performers like Olympians, world record holders, and MVP athletes from various major sports. In today's episode, Michael talks about what it takes to master your mind and get into peak performance every day. He dives into many strategies for overcoming your fears, training your mind, and conditioning yourself for success. If you're wondering how to program your mind for success and take charge of your life every single day, check this episode out now. You are going to love it. We all know how tough it can be to find a good, high-quality razor, but luckily for you, I've done just that in Harry's. I got out of the shower about an hour ago, and man, I have to say, I absolutely love Harry's razors. The quality of the blades, the closeness of the shave, the comfortableness of the glide when using the razors. It's fast, it's easy to use, and man, I absolutely love it. And Harry's is so confident you're going to love their blades, they'll give you their trial shave set for free when you sign up at Harry's.com/eliteman. Just pay for the shipping and that is all. Harry's is all about a great shave at a fair price, which is why over 3 million guys have switched over to Harry's. Claim your free trial offer from Harry's today, a $13 value for free when you sign up. Again, all you gotta do is cover the shipping. Your free trial set includes a weighted ergonomic razor handle, 5 precision engineered blades with a lubricating strip and trimmer blade, a rich lathering shave gel, which I gotta say makes you smell phenomenal, and a travel blade cover as well for when you're on the road. To get your free trial set, go to harrys.com/eliteman right now. Again, that's harrys.com/eliteman. I know you are going to absolutely love these razors just like I do. All right, guys, we're live. It's Justin Stenstrom from EliteManMagazine.com, and my guest today is Dr. Michael Gervais. Dr. Michael, thanks so much for coming on the show, man.
Oh, thanks for having me. Really appreciate being part of this conversation with you.
Yeah, absolutely, man. You know, I got info. I got your background info from your assistant a few weeks or months back, and I was really impressed, man, with sort of your resume and the work you do. You're a high performance psychologist, and you've worked with the Seattle Seahawks, some of the top performers in the world. You know, New York Times bestsellers, celebrities, you know, Olympians, guys, and people like that. And just, you know, really impressed with kind of how the mind plays a huge role into top performance. And yeah, I just want to pick your brain today on kind of how ordinary people, I guess, can use the science and techniques that you teach top performers and how to implement that into their life.
You know, thank you. And what, you know, one of the things I've come to learn is that the people that do extraordinary things, they're fundamentally not that different than you and me. Mm-hmm. They are very much humans. They're very much structured in the same ways. And they have figured out, though, ways to be very progressive about improvement. And they structure their life around getting better. So this idea that I start to get nauseated by in pop culture right now is like, what are the 7 steps, or what's the hack, or there are no hacks. There are no secrets. There are no 7 steps. It's a fundamental orientation to structure your life and organize your life in a way to grow, to get better. And it's not complicated. And I love to talk about this, as maybe you can already tell. I love to talk about this. I've been at it for 20 years trying to sort out what are the themes and streams and what are the tactics and strategies that people use on the world stage to get better. And there's only 3 things that we can train as humans. You can train our body, you can train your craft, and you can train your mind. And I'm squarely sitting in that conversation about what are the most optimized ways of thinking and training our mind to be extraordinary.
Yeah, it's really cool, man. That's probably the most fascinating too to me of all 3 things that you can train. And how did you get into this? I mean, you said you've been doing this for about 20 years or so. How did you kind of dive into
high performance psychology and working with some of these top experts or, you know, performers in the world?
Well, there's always a longer story and a shorter story. Which one would you rather have?
I guess we'll take the shorter one for now and then maybe pick it apart.
Yeah, that's good. Okay. Let me just do the academic path, and I'll start with the scratching the surface of the story, is that when I was a young high school athlete, there was a significant difference between how I could perform in practice and how I could perform in competitions. And I was not better. I didn't know how to quote unquote rise to the occasion. And looking back now, it's because I was anxious. I was nervous and my mind was getting in the way of me being able to access my craft, the thing that I had trained for years and, prior to. And so what happened is that I was just sick and tired of being small and feeling small and not being able to let it rip and enjoy the demonstration to myself of what I've come to learn. And instead, I was so consumed with what other people were thinking about me. And that's kind of the source of most people's anxiety, is for our ancient brain in modern times, one of the greatest threats is other people's opinions. It's no longer, the saber-toothed tigers or the man in the dark alley, which today, there are those threats, but they're far less in between than what is more common as a threat, which is a silly threat in many ways, which is a potential other person's opinion. And so what ended up happening is that I went and studied it, and because I wanted to figure out how to have freedom, internal freedom. And so that's how it started. It started from pain, just like most good stories. There's some sort of discomfort and pain that begins a shift. And so I got an undergraduate degree in psychology, a master's degree in kinesiology, and then there wasn't quite enough there. So I went back and got a PhD in psychology, licensed as a psychologist in California with a specialization in sport and performance, and then figured out I didn't know much. And I spent a lot of time in trenches in very hostile and high-stakes environments, like very rugged environments, to add to and learn from how the mind and body work together in environments where sometimes it's life and death or sometimes it's life and limb.
What types of environments were these? What are you like referring to?
Well, okay. So there's some that you'd be familiar with and some that you might not be familiar with. So I cut my teeth in MMA and really understanding how mixed martial artists operate, and then what's the difference between their training and when they compete, when the gloves come off. And then some of the projects you might be more familiar with is Red Bull Stratos, which is where I was fortunate enough to work with the Red Bull Stratos team to help Felix Baumgartner jump from 130,000 feet and be the first person to do that, to travel the speed of sound and pass through what ended up being a double sonic boom. And the brightest minds in aerospace were not sure if his arms and legs were going to stay intact as he was passing through, the atmosphere at such speed. So wow. Projects like that. And then Olympics are certainly high stakes, but not necessarily dangerous and rugged. And I was fortunate enough to learn from some incredibly talented Olympians over the last 12 years as well.
Yeah, that's really cool. How fast was that guy, Felix Baumgartner, going? What is the speed of, speed of sound?
Yeah, so it's Mach 1. He jumped from 130,000 feet. So the speed changes when the relativity of speed changes as there's nothing next to you. So it's like if you're really low in a go-kart, so to speak, and you're paying attention to how fast you're going, like the trees are ripping by you, right? Mm-hmm. But if you're really high up in an airplane and you're traveling five times the speed, it's hard to tell how fast you're going. So he was at 130,000 feet, where airplanes travel at 30,000 feet. So, he was literally passed through and broke the sound barrier.
How many miles per hour is that?
Yeah, I think, well, okay, that was right. 877 or something along those lines, I think, is where he clocked his speed. And it's been 5 years since that project, so I should double back and check as my memory fails me a bit on that.
Mm-hmm. Wow, that's really cool. So what were some of the things you were working on with Felix specifically to get him to, I guess, achieve that incredible feat?
Well, there's, like we talked about earlier, there's three things that we can train. And out of those three things, mind, body, and craft, and he was one of the best in the world at his craft, which was being able to jump from high spaces, low spaces as a base jumper, being able to control himself with a parachute. And this was a new territory for him. So training his mind on how to rely on a team, as opposed to his former decades of work and body of work, was how he needed to rely on himself. And if you think about base jumpers and folks that parachute, that they need to totally rely on themselves, as well as be deeply connected to Mother Nature, the wind and the sensations. And they are so finely tuned at those two elements that those that survive end up making great decisions. In this project, Felix was in a capsule in a NASA-engineered spacesuit, or an aerospace spacesuit. So he had a complete disconnection from Mother Nature, and he had to rely on other people. So it was a complete mental shift to know how to learn to deeply trust oneself, which is his former career, to the second part of his career, which is learn how to trust others. And to do that, there's a handful of mental skills that we would train. Calm, confidence, focus, optimism, having clarity of the vision and goals. Make sure that we double down on mindfulness practices to become more aware of our thoughts, our emotions, our body sensations, so that we can adjust and choose thoughts that are productive and work for us, so that we're not caught in some negative spiral that creates mental constriction as well as physical constriction. Because it's those episodes or brief moments of constriction in hostile environments that get people killed or, unfortunately maimed in some way. So, or injured, I should say. I don't want to be overly dramatic, but, that's what it looks like. And I just did a quick check while we were speaking, is that Felix Baumgartner traveled 833.9 miles per hour.
Wow. That's incredible. And yeah. Nothing happened to him, right?
No, he survived. Yeah. And it was a event that took place, and it was a true aerospace investigation, because some of the brightest minds didn't know what would happen if somebody needed to pull the eject button as they're on their way to Mars. Like, could they survive that type of fall? And so that was part of the process of figuring it out. And he had the skills and he had the bold vision to be able to position himself to be that person to try it out. So it changed the way we understand what's possible, literally, in aerospace. And it was an honor to be part of that project.
Yeah, that's really cool. What so I guess if I'm hearing you right, it's a combination of a lot of different teachings and disciplines, things like meditation, breath work, self-talk, that kind of stuff. And using like all those tools, how long did you work with Felix for, and how long did it take for him to like really get that part down?
Okay, so great question. It's a very sensitive, timely. The time of it is different than like what it takes to secure the skills. So let me see if I can pull that thoughtful question into a way that I think will be a good answer. Is that he was already world class at something in his life, so he already knew every one of these skills, but now it's just learning how to reapply them when the structure and the environment are fundamentally different. And that's hard. That is hard to do. So it's not like we had to start from ground zero, but what happened in this project, and this is all public, I'm not talking about something that is not public. Matter of fact, I think ESPN this year is going to run a full special on this very subject that we're talking about, is like the mind inside the mental skills and the mental skills training that Felix went through. So it was about 4 years into the project where Felix said, I can't do it anymore. I'm done. I've run out of mental skills to be able to be in the spacesuit. And I feel claustrophobic. I feel like I can't think. And I'm having mini panic attacks. And I'm done. We got to call this thing off. And now that was 4 years in, and, I don't know, maybe 6 to 8 people that were full-time on the project, and millions, tens of millions in dollars at that point invested in the project. And so that's when a colleague on the team introduced me to the project to see if we could work with him to extinguish the fear that he was having. And so extinguishing fear is very different than learning how to manage fear. And I didn't want to leave it up to chance that he was going to have to manage his fear in that way at 130,000 feet. So we really worked from a very aggressive scientific platform to extinguish fear. And so how long did it take? It was a work, very intense work, and it was brief, and it was somewhere near, under 3 weeks. And so, but very intense work.
Wow. So was he working on this for 4 years, like unsuccessfully trying to get past his fears, and then you came and kind of corrected him in 3 weeks? Or was he kind of doing other stuff for 4 years, and then like towards the end of it, they needed some extra help and brought you on?
Yeah, it was a four, good question. It was a 4 week, I'm sorry, 4 year project that there was a lot going on. And it wasn't until maybe the last 6 months that he started to have the intensity of the claustrophobic feelings and the anxiety and the panic attacks around it. So it was like, it was like that was the hurdle that was happening at that point in the project. And I think the project went on for another 3 years, something like that. So it was a short pivotal window that I was fortunate enough to be part of. And we just had our 5th year anniversary last weekend. And so all of us got together, or a bunch of us, I should say, got together in the States to be able to celebrate the 5th year of that project.
Cool. Yeah. So, I mean, that's still, really impressive either way. I mean, 3 weeks and basically wiping this guy's fears completely off and, helping him achieve such an incredible thing.
I want to be more precise. It wasn't all fears. It was the fear of claustrophobic responses. Yeah.
I mean, claustrophobia is a big phobia for a lot of people. I'm in particular, I'm not a fan of elevators. It's like the one thing I hate doing is riding elevators. What's your best like recommendation for getting past something like claustrophobia or another phobia, maybe arachnophobia, fear of spiders or fear of flying? Like what is your best tool in that process of getting over a major fear like that?
Yeah, so I think, it's a tough question to answer because there's no like simple answer, but there's a combination, a confluence of ways of thinking and mental skills trainings that people can do. So the first order is like, you don't have to get in an elevator. You don't have to. It's a choice that you're making and it's a luxury and you can take the stairs or you cannot take the meeting. Or if you live in that apartment, you could move to a brownstone or you could live to, somewhere that is on the first floor. Like there's ways that you can organize your life to not do that thing. But that's not a great answer. So, but it's kind of like, hey, check yourself. You don't have to do these things. These are all things that you're choosing to do in your life. And if you're choosing to do them, like maybe just see these things as gifts. And then, so that's part of it. And then the second part, and the reason I say that's not a good solution to avoid those things is because then we end up living in this little bubble, like of things that are comfortable. And that's the surest and fastest way to decay as a human is to just play it safe and play it small and, reduce your stress levels to only those things that bring you temporary pleasure. And like that's a fundamental error that I think some people do make because they're so tired, from working the 9-to-5 or 9-to-7 job. And they just don't want to think about doing hard work afterwards to grow. So, I know that's not exactly what you're asking. But so then the other part is learn how to control and maybe even master the things that are in your control. So your response to a closed space is 100% in your control. And when you start to learn about what are the things that are really in your control, there's only a few. And they all can be boiled down to 100% of the time you're responsible for your thoughts and 100% of the time you're responsible for your actions. So you might not know what your thoughts are. If you don't know your thoughts, it's hard to have great thoughts. And so the awareness piece is like it all kind of just begins and ends with awareness. And so it's that awareness piece that is the practice of mindfulness. It has come to be a great accelerant. But awareness alone is not enough. If you're aware that, oh my God, my heart's pounding, I'm sweating, I'm in this closed space. Oh my God, my heart's pounding, I'm starting to sweat. Are other people noticing? Oh my gosh, look how they're looking at me. I'm aware that now they're looking at me and I feel really uncomfortable. So awareness alone is not enough. But awareness that your thoughts are driving your physical and emotional experience, that's really important. So once you have awareness, then you can train or literally condition yourself to redirect your thoughts or choose more optimal thoughts. And when you do, when you figure out how to do that on a regular basis, the world fundamentally changes, like in incredible ways. The space and freedom that people report having is noticed. And so I know it's not a simple question, but it's awareness first and then the skill to redirect your thoughts to something that is productive. And when I say productive, it means it just builds more internal space. Every thought we have either constricts us or builds expansion, right? And so the constricting thoughts are like, I suck, or, oh my God, this is going to go bad, or, you know, I don't know if this is ever going to work out, or I'm not built for this, or get me out of here. Those are all constricting type thoughts. And expansion thoughts are like, you know, I choose to be here. I feel a little anxious, so let me just work on some breathing. Let me focus all of my attention on a proper inhale and then a long exhale. And that's the only thing I need to do right now, just exhale. And so like that would be something that would be more productive, create more space.
Yeah, that's I have to completely agree with that, man. Like I said, I don't particularly like riding in elevators, but I ride them. I don't have my dislike of them isn't so bad where I have to completely avoid them or I have like a panic attack, you know, if I go on them. I just prefer not to ride them, and I've learned kind of how to deal with the dislike of them. So I'll go in elevators and I'll kind of do what you're talking about here anyways. Like I have an awareness of, you know, what I'm thinking, and you know, every so often there'll be like negative thoughts, and then like you'll have like this surge of anxiety creep through you, and then it's like, you know what, you take a deep breath, kind of relax, and then think of something more positive, like something else pops into your head. Another thing too that, you know, I just thought of is I do all kinds of, you know, biohacking stuff and health related stuff. All, you know, through the years I've done many things. I did hyperbaric oxygen therapy a few years back, which if anyone, you know, is familiar with that, if you're familiar with it, Michael, basically you go into a chamber, a sealed chamber, and they pressurized air, and you just breathe in like 100% oxygen, and it's good for, you know, it has many health benefits. But you know, you go in there by yourself, and basically it's an enclosed space. It's tiny, and like you're just in this, you know, there's a tiny little hole, to like a little window at the top of it, and you can't see anything else, and you're just, you know, locked in basically for an hour. And that was scary. Thinking of, you know, doing that, I ended up doing it for about a month. And that was scary. Before every session, I'd have like a little anxiety about that. But again, I'd get in the chamber and, you know, I'd bring a book and just kind of focus on, you know, breathing, just relaxing and not thinking about being in the chamber itself. And after a while, I got kind of good at counteracting that initial anxiety and just being okay with being in an enclosed space like that. So, yeah, it's really about, I think, just focusing your being aware first, but then focusing your thoughts on something positive. And again, the breathing aspect is really important too, because that allows you to kind of shift your mind and shift your focus off the negative thoughts that might be popping in your head.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there you've employed and applied some very good science behind that. So absolutely.
As far as like meditation, mindfulness, do you have any specific techniques for people to use in general, not just like with anxiety, but kind of like day-to-day stuff?
Yes, of course. That, you know, mindfulness training it's been around for 2,500 plus years, and there's incredible science right now that is suggesting changes in the brain structurally, changes in the electrical patterns of the brain, changes in the neurochemistry of the brain, as well as changes in the psychology of humans, meaning that we see the world differently and feel and experience the world in more optimized ways, both from a health and perspective standpoint, as well as a performance standpoint. So getting this right is, I think, a significant advancement to the quality of one's life. And so let's dispel a couple myths first. One is, meditation and or mindfulness, we can use those words interchangeably. There is a subtle difference between the two, but the word meditation conjures up some sort of hippie image that I want to avoid for this part of the conversation. And so for this part of the conversation, let's talk about training and literal training of your mind and use the word mindfulness. Is that there's two types. The first type is called single point mindfulness, and the second is called contemplative or contemplative mindfulness. And so the first single point is literally just focusing on one thing at a time over and over and over again. And what you'll notice is that your mind will wander. And so the mistake is not, here's the pitfalls or mistakes that people make. Man, I can't do that. I can't have no thoughts. That's right. That's exactly right. So as soon as your mind wanders and starts to have some thoughts about what you're doing, if you're doing it right, if you're critiquing, you know, or the critiques you're making of yourself, that's all noise. And it's fine. It's part of it, because it's not until you notice and have the moment of awareness that you're off from the one thing that you get the opportunity to refocus back to the one thing. And what is the one thing? Well, it could be anything, really. I mean, it could be an inhale that followed by a pause, and then followed by an exhale, followed by a pause, followed by an inhale. So, you know, literally deep breathing. Or it could be a dot on the wall. It could be a sound you make. It could be the food that you're swallowing. It's just the one thing that is elementary to your focus. So mindfulness is a focus training, a deep focus training, not a relaxation training. It's a deep focus training that gives you the opportunity to notice when you are away from the present. A la the one thing, the single point. So that's it. I mean, that's the mechanics in a nutshell. And then science would suggest that a minimal effective dose, and it's even hard to butcher an ancient practice with that phrase of minimal effective dose, but like a minimal effective dose to get some structural and electrical and psychological benefits is somewhere around 8 minutes a day, 6, 7, 8 minutes a day in that frame. And an optimal dose is 20 minutes on average for the rest of your life. And I can't tell you how important it's been for me as a human trying to become the best me I can, that this has been phenomenally important, as well as scores of world-class, literally world-leading performers, whether it be the arts or business or sports, where this has been an accelerant to their growth as well.
Is that single point and contemplative, or is that just single point, the benefits?
Both. There's no right and wrong. There's okay. Just two main ways, single point and contemplative. So the contemplative is, I think it's harder. I think it's a bit more advanced. I think it requires just a little more sophistication and emotional control. And what that is just simply observing your thoughts without judgment. That's it. And so just go on a ride and see where you go and watch and experience and notice the feelings and notice the emotions and notice the body sensations. Notice the thoughts that trigger those or that come right after those, and just follow without judgment, without critique, and you will go somewhere. and sometimes you'll learn things about yourself that you've been avoiding for a long time. And sometimes you'll have a great ride, you know. And so single point and contemplative are the two basic ways. And there's thousands of subtypes. There's walking, there's eating, there's listening, there's thousands of subtypes. But those are the two basic frames.
What do you know, like, the science behind? Because I know, like, more and more research is coming out, like you said, just proving the efficacy of how powerful meditation and mindfulness is. What is the science behind what's happening, like, in the brain and the body? Do you know?
Yeah, I've spent a lot of time studying it. I mean, I could take you all over the map, but maybe you've got, like, do you have something more specific that I could drill in for you? Like that you might be interested?
Yeah, perhaps like what's happening like in the brain and you know, cortisol levels and things like that, like heartbeat, blood pressure, like that kind of the health benefits of, you know, surrounding that kind of stuff.
All of that. Yes, the answer is yes. And, you know, I think it's fair to say we're not exactly sure how, but yes to all of that. And there's some performance-based studies that I think are really important that I'll reference. And you know, there's two studies in 2009, 2011 that we found that, or they, the researchers found that those that practice mindfulness had an increased frequency of flow state. And flow state is, athletes call it the zone, musicians call it being in the pocket. It's the most optimal state a human can be in. And again, it's phenomenal to think that those that practice mindfulness have an increased frequency in the most optimal state. And to me, that's phenomenal. I actually don't need a whole lot more, because that grabs my attention in such a significant way. And then if we want to keep going, those that practice mindfulness have an increased attention and concentration. And there's scores of studies there. Those that practice mindfulness, it's been found that they have an enhanced performance in high intense contexts, you know, like rugged and hostile environments. Those that practice mindfulness, there was a study I'm thinking of in 2014 where there was they responded better to stress and had better emotional regulation. There's better parenting skills. And so I know I'm not doing brain. I'm doing behavioral stuff first, and I'll do brain in a minute. And it's also been plenty of studies that those who practice mindfulness have improved sleep. They have more balanced mood and have decreases in fatigue as well. Mm-hmm. So, man, there's got to be something on that list that's of interest. Even if you didn't understand the basic, which I think what I'm about to say is, I'm going to back it up, is that even if you didn't understand the basic frames of the brain or neurochemistry or neuroelectrical activity across the brain, that doesn't matter. It's like these outcomes are phenomenal. Not to mention that mindfulness is also, it's not about performance. You know, that's like the gold dust that happens. It's about a deep focus and commitment, a relentless and uncommon commitment to the present moment, for one reason really, which is to become more insightful and to potentially reveal the insight and wisdom that a person has within them. So enhanced performance and enhanced functioning is a side effect of the gold dust that happens, but it's not the primary purpose. With insight and wisdom, the whole world changes because you see and understand the world in a deeper and more fundamental, honest way. And I think that those are some of the things that I would suggest are foundational.
Yeah. As far as the brain part is concerned, what do you think is actually happening? Do you think it is like the neuroplasticity effect where the brain is actually like changing itself and you know, making more connections, forming more neurons and just making everything more like solid and, you know, intertwined? Is that literally like what's happening when you do mindfulness, when you practice mindfulness meditation?
There's lots of ways for what you just described to take place in the brain. Being on the edge of a cliff where you're about to jump off of a 40-foot spine in the backcountry of Canada into an uncharted track with just you and your buddy and two skis, you're going to get some changes in your brain. And what you're going to get is an aliveness that takes place and a full integration and syncopation of electrical activity, movement, and neurochemistry. So you can get what you describe from a lot of different ways. Learning and trying to solve problems will create a change in the brain, which is the more colloquial way of talking about neuroplasticity. So yes, and what we know from mindfulness is that it's really an integrator. So it integrates mind, thoughts, awareness, and body, and with the brain. And so our brain is this 3 pounds of silly putty that sits in our skull that is a mystery still. We don't know what it is. Like, we don't really know how it functions. We know that there's no redundancies in the brain. We know that it's beyond our comprehension how it came to be. We don't exactly know how it works, but we know that in many ways we are muting our experience. So there are more colors in the world than we can see. There's more sounds in the world that we can see or that we can hear. But our functional filters that we have, our eyeballs and our eardrums, prevent us from the distortion of prevent us by distorting the true nature of what is. So the green thing that you're looking at, the tree outside your room or whatever, it's different shades. It's a deeper shades likely than what you can even perceive. So what ends up happening with mindfulness is that there's a deeper integration so that you can perceive at a higher capacity and a higher rate. And what it essentially does, it trains your mind to be more familiar with the present moment. And the way to get more out of life, whether it's from a performance standpoint or a wisdom standpoint, is to spend more time in the present moment. And when you get glimpses of stitching the present moment together, 2, 3, 4, 5 moments together, 10, 15, 20 moments together, we will get glimpses of our potential. We'll reveal insight and wisdom at a higher rate. So, I don't want to get too lost in the kind of the craziness of the brain, because we start to talk about funky words that lead us down to rabbit holes that are really exciting and interesting to me. But I think that, I'm much more interested in the function of what takes place from a behavioral or psychological standpoint.
Are there any other techniques, strategies for getting yourself to live in the present moment, to be present and just enjoy what you're doing more? I mean, aside from meditation, aside from mindfulness?
Certainly. There's lots, actually. You know, living at the edge of danger will help you live in the present moment. It might not help you with wisdom and insight, but it will, like, if you've got, you know, a situation where there's imminent danger or risk, you better be switched on. And if your ancestor didn't give you that gift, you got problems, right? And so our ancient brain is designed to be optimal on the edge of danger or in the midst of danger. However, our modern mind, our ancient brain with our modern mind, it's a little out of whack because we don't have the same dangers our ancestors had. And so, yes, ways to live present, run to the edge of your capacities. Run to the edge. And I don't mean huck yourself off a 30-foot or 40-foot spine if you're not skilled. But the rest of us can certainly be vulnerable more often, be right at the edge of not knowing what someone's going to say because you've said something that's truthful and it allows potentially someone to dismiss you or use it against you later. But without vulnerability, you'll never experience intimacy. Without intimacy, you really won't understand the texture of the human nature of what it means. And without real connection, we don't experience extraordinary lives, you know, and we're not in this alone. There's not a single athlete that I've ever worked with on the world stage, even individual athlete, that has done it alone. Their parents, their coaches, their sports nutritionists, you know, their uncles, their sponsors, even if the only person on the field or the pitch or the court is one person at a time, we don't do this alone. And so if we can amplify our relationships by being more connected to each other, we are actually doing something by default, which is becoming more present through vulnerability. And again, I'm unwinding this concept, is that to do that, we have to run to the edge daily of our instability, of the edges of our instability.
Yeah, I love it. You know, I tell guys this all the time, like pushing yourself out of your comfort zone is one of the best things you can do to yourself, especially when it comes to gaining confidence in a particular area, like social situations. If, you know, you want to get more confidence with talking to girls, or you want to, you know, be better on stage when you deliver a speech, there's different things you can do socially to just, you know, doing stuff that literally scares the shit out of you will push you to limits and expose you to things that will just change your whole outlook on life. Like, I took dance classes before. I was the only guy, and there was 30 women in the class, and I couldn't dance for shit, and I still can't dance now. But getting, like, past that class, it was like a four-month class, gave me the confidence that I could basically go up and talk to anybody I wanted to. I took an acting class, and, you know, the skills I learned from acting, the confidence I got from taking that acting class, I then was able to transition into giving speeches in front of, you know, hundreds of people later on because I had that confidence that I could push myself beyond what I thought was previously my limits.
Yeah, that sounds right. And, you know, that it's almost in many ways an overused thing, get comfortable being uncomfortable. To be able to do that well, though, there has to be a value system of what you really want. And if you really want growth in your life, then of course you're going to do that. And on the world stage in athletics and business, we never talk about that, really, because everyone's doing it. Everyone's working their ass off to be as competent and progressive as they possibly can. We are right now working as hard as humans can work. So we talk more about recovery. We don't talk about working hard. That's like, you know, it's an assumption. It's a necessary requirement, but not enough.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a given. Going back to something you mentioned earlier with your work with MMA fighters, what are some of the things that you can use to help people get past their fears? I'm thinking back when I did like wrestling in high school, boxing. There was always like a lot of fear that I sort of took away from the performance of how I wanted to perform in those different situations, like a wrestling match. If there was another guy and I knew he was like, say, a state champion or something, I'd get, you know, a little too anxious before the match, and then I'd end up losing because, you know, I didn't perform at my peak. Where if I, you know, just thought he was some bum off the street and he couldn't wrestle, I think I tended to do a lot better. Do you kind of run into this thing from time to time with MMA fighters or other peak performers where they can kind of shift their mindset in the moment and not worry about, you know, their fears of losing or their fears of doing bad when they're up against a big challenge?
Yeah, I think that's the whole game of mental training, is that to front load the way that you think in life so that it doesn't alter at the moment that you have a competitor in front of you or people watching or, you know, 1 second to go on the clock. It's like we want to front load the ways that we think on a regular basis so it becomes automatic. And also we want to front load the physical training so that we're in those conditions that our movements become automatic. And when that happens, we can fall in syncopation with the present moment and we can be on time, like not ahead of time, not behind time, but on time with this moment. So we don't want to wait until the lights are on to say, oh my gosh, how am I supposed to think here? Or we don't want to do the rookie mistake, which is like, well, once I get a couple good shots in and then I'll feel confident. No, like we want to go in knowing exactly how we're going to think about and be in the present moment more often, whether we've made a mistake, whether we're getting punched in the mouth, or whether, you know, we're on top. And so that's why we front load the mental and physical training as best we can. So for me, I'm not on the physical training side. I'm on the mental training side, which is, you know, like a pretty simple question. And I don't want to set you up in any way, but like, where does confidence come from? Is it so more, even more basic? Is confidence important? I think you'd say, yeah, of course. You know, it's a cornerstone. Like, yeah. And then when we ask the question, where does it come from? Most people say preparation or past success. Neither of those are enough. They're important, but neither are enough, because that begs the question, if the model is that something comes before me to be confident, and if that thing is positive, then I feel okay. But what if the thing is negative? Do I feel bad? Doubt, self-critique, right? Or like have a constriction that we're talking about earlier. So that model is not good enough. Self-confidence only comes from one place. And you're going to say, yeah, of course. It's what you say to yourself. Well, if that's the case, then we need to front load and figure out the most optimal ways of thinking and speaking to oneself, independent of success or failure. And you know this, and like you've probably felt this yourself, is that, but I've been fortunate enough to work with people that the anthem is playing, they're at the top of the podium, the gold medal around their neck, the rings are behind them, and they've had that experience, the best in the world at the Olympics. Then the next competition they go into, they come back and they're like, I'm still a nervous wreck. You know, like I thought that the past success would take care of it. Like I'm the best in the world. Why am I still anxious? Why am I still, you know, jittery the night before and the morning of? What's going on here? Because the self-talk is not right. The self-talk hasn't changed. Your experiences have changed, but the experiences haven't changed your script. They haven't changed your story. They haven't changed the way that you interpret information. And again, all of that is trainable.
Yeah, so I guess in my case, it was like, you know, I was beat even before I stepped on the mat. It was, yeah, everything's supposed to be happening before, and you're training yourself before, you're training your mind before all this, you know, the performance actually happens, before the match happens or whatever it is. What, speaking on self-talk, like what are the strategies for good self-talk? Is it like positive affirmations constantly throughout the day?
I want, like, okay, yes and no. I feel like a seventh grader saying, oh, just say good things to yourself. That'll work. You know, no, it's like, come on, figure out for, like, here's the alone work. You have to do the alone work to say, how do I speak to myself that builds expansion, that builds space, that builds my confidence? How do I speak to myself? And then make a fundamental commitment, write it down, like, so you can see it. But for every statement that you make, like, I'm a tough mother effer, right? If you're going to make that statement to yourself, you better be able to back it up with some real stuff in your life. But write it down. So that's what I do. I call it the epic thought list. And then for every epic thought that you have, like, I'm a tough man, or I'm the most resilient woman, or I'm a tough woman, whatever it might be, then list at least three reasons in your history that give you the right to say it. And so that's the beginnings part of the work. Nobody can tell you what to say. You've got to earn it. And then you've got to have the toughness about you to believe that that's a true statement. The toughness is about knowing who you are and being you in any environment, whether you're down by 31 points in a playoff game, which the Seattle Seahawks were in a couple years ago. No one's ever come back from a 31 deficit. But we train, Coach Carroll, myself included, and we select through John Schneider and the general manager and all the scouts. We look for people that are progressive in wanting to become the very best. They come into the organization pre-screened for optimism. Why optimism? Because we want to help people have a framework, or we want to find people and then help them have a very clear framework. Stay in it because it's about to get great. Stay in it. I know we just got two turnovers, pick sixes, and we're down by 14, but an optimistic framework by definition is that the future is going to be bright. Stay in it. It's the core and center of mental toughness. So walking into, we're down by 31 points. Who are we playing? We're playing the Panthers. And Cam Newton was running the show for us, and we were out of sorts completely. And the team is a very good team. The Seahawks are a very good team. And going into we're in the tunnel heading back into the locker room at halftime. And one of the, I'll keep him nameless just because it feels respectful to do so. He leans over to me and says, Gervais, this is going to be the greatest comeback in the history of the NFL playoffs. Watch this. I was like, there you go. That's optimism. You know, like that's what it is. And when you have a group of people that have a reality-based lens that the future is going to work out right, you end up doing some pretty extraordinary things. Pessimism, that's learned too. And people that are pessimistic, they don't call themselves pessimists. They call themselves realists, you know, as if an optimist isn't real, like some sort of fairy tale story that they say to themselves. But the reason people are pessimists or cynics is because they've been burned, or they saw their parents be burned, and they don't want to put themselves in that vulnerable position to be burned again. So they play it safe, they hold back, and they tell a story to themselves that's not going to work out. So I don't know any pessimists on the world stage that that are world leading and disruptive in, you know, changing the way things work. And so if you find yourself being being pessimistic, you know, I think check yourself. And by the way, it's not fun. it's not fun to be a pessimist cynic. Like, it's just not fun. And so it's so much fun to learn and to be on the edge. And I just sat down right before this conversation with a 4-time Olympian, 2-time medalist. Think about that. Best in the world for 20 years. And he says, everything I've learned has been through mistakes. The most significant things have come from loss and the pain and discomfort from it, not from the winning. And like, you hear that and you say, yeah, that sounds good. You hear that. But then why do we tighten up when we're about to get our ass kicked? We're about to learn something. You know, so, and we're about to be better. And he said, you know, every once in a while I'll put my medal around my neck when I'm going to go do a public event for speaking. He goes, but I wear the medal every day around my neck of the things that I've learned to be a better man, a better husband, a better dad. And I'm telling you that for me, that speaks volumes.
Is there anything else besides writing it down that you can think of or being optimistic? Like, is it self-talk? Is it throughout the day, or is it typically just like, and I guess for all mental training for this matter, is it's like a specific time of day? You know how you work out, like these guys are training their bodies, you know, they'll work out for 3 or whatever, 6 hours in some cases a day, and it's like constant, you know, practice. Is the mind training that you're doing, is that constant practice as well? Like, you know, a set aside 2 hours or set aside 1 hour a day, or is it more like constant thinking throughout the day and just being positive in those aspects throughout the day?
Well, yes and no. I mean, there's two parts of it. One is that alone work that I was talking about. That's like building the foundation. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd say, you know, be very clear about your philosophy in life. Write it down. 10 words, 20 words, maybe 2. Write down your frickin' philosophy. Write down your mission in life. What are you doing? You know, like, and I say that with contempt, like, seriously, it's really hard to do. Like, but what are you doing with your life? Write it down. And then let those be some bookstones. Not bookstones, what are they called? Bookends. Like, this is where I'm going in my life, and this is who I'm becoming. That's what a philosophy is. A philosophy, it's a fancy phrase for guiding principles. Okay, so that's good. But the work that you're talking about, and then, I'm sorry, I'm skipping ahead. And then the writing down the epic thoughts and the back it up, that's alone-based work. Nobody can do that work for you. Now, imagery, mental imagery, the science around imagery is really strong. And there's physiological changes that take place where people become better grooved at a neurological level of patterns, pattern recognition, efficiency of movement. It's been found to enhance confidence. And so mental imagery can be practiced. It's a skill, which means either you're good at the skill or not good because you haven't practiced it. And so setting aside time, call it 15 minutes, maybe it's 20 minutes, to see yourself experiencing you at the highest levels. That is what basically imagery is. But it's not just seeing it. It's feeling it, smelling it, hearing it, being absorbed in it. And then, like, you know, the clear recommendation is like an 85-15 percentage split. So 85% of your time, see yourself like kicking ass and doing it right and being really precise. And then 15% of the time, seeing yourself being in very compromised positions and figuring out how to work it out there. So like an 85-15 split.
What are your thoughts on the like the secret and visualizing? Because I mean, it seems like you're big on visualization. But what are your thoughts on like visualizing and making things happen? Like the whole what is it? The law of attraction and you know, willing things to happen just by seeing it in that sense. Is that all bullshit or is there something to that?
Show me the science. I don't know any of the science from that book, from that movie. Interesting concept. If you imagine a red bicycle, you'll have one. Where's the science? Now, there is incredible science on imagery. There is incredible science there, but there's nothing mystical about it. And so this is about training your mind to condition your body to perform in certain ways in the future. That's all I'm talking about. And those research, many hundreds and thousands of research studies have found incredible changes for people that do that. So, nope, I'm not saying, please, you know, my stomach is turning upside down that even anything I said conjured up the idea of, you know, the secret. There's no secrets. There are no secrets.
Cool. And just a couple more questions, man. We're going to kind of wrap things up. Can you just talk, though, about your experience with the Seahawks and working with Pete Carroll? Because he is a fascinating guy, one of the best coaches, I think, in NFL history. And I guess what have you learned from working with the Seahawks and in particular Pete Carroll?
Coach Carroll is extraordinary at switching on cultures that help people become their very best. And so much so, going into our first Super Bowl together, he said in the hallway one day, hey, Mike, can you feel how amazing this is here? And I was like, it is on. And he says, hey, do you think anyone inside of sport, outside of sport, would be interested in what we're doing here? And I didn't even have a moment to think. And he says, let's just write it down. Write down what you've been doing here. Write down what I'm going to write down what I've been doing. Let's find those things that we've been doing together and see if we can create some sort of training experience for people outside of sport. And so on the backs of two Super Bowls and playoffs since, we built this nice little joint venture together called Compete to Create. And you can find more information on competetocreate.net. And it's a 4-week online course that's right now, unfortunately, for your listeners, it's only available for people inside of large corporations, you know, with tens of hundreds of thousands of people. And so it's coming to the masses soon, but we're not ready for that scale at this point. But if somebody is a director or leader in an organization, we'd love to, you know, introduce you to the concepts. And so it's literally just literally what this program is helping people condition and train their mind to become their very best. It's that simple of an idea. And what I've learned from him is that you can create cultures that bring the best out of people, that in very rugged environments that are based in an authentic, deep relationship. So what I've learned from Coach Carroll is at the center, he wants to be and aspires to be a relationship-based coach that is a blend of old school values and progressive technologies to help people be more connected and aware to themselves and each other to do extraordinary things together. And you know, becoming a relationship-based coach is just a beautiful concept. And so that's one of many hundreds of things that I've learned from my time at the Seahawks and with Coach Carroll.
Cool. Are you still with the Seahawks now? If not, what are you up to now?
I am. Yeah. I'm currently with them now. And I've also gone on a very similar journey maybe that you have, to continue to learn from people on the frontier. And so we've got a podcast as well called Finding Mastery. And in that podcast, it's conversations with, you know, world's best in a variety of domains. And whether it be LA Lakers coach Luke Walton, whether it's Arianna Huffington, some of the four thinkers in mindfulness, Judson Brewer, John Kabat-Zinn, you know, and multiple Olympians and professional athletes as well. So it's been just a joy to, you know, ask questions to try to better understand how they've done what they've done, and try to stitch that together with the science background that I have. And so it's been great. I've really loved it.
Yeah, it's one of my favorite things, you know, doing all the different kind of things I do in my job here. It's probably the funnest is interviewing people and, you know, top experts in the world, just getting to pick their minds. It's like a free coaching session for about an hour or so with some of the people you look up to. So it's really cool. Michael, just kind of wrapping things up, man, is there a last send-off takeaway message you'd like to leave the Elite Man audience, man? It's been a fascinating interview. I really appreciate your time. And then also a place you'd like to send our listeners to check out more about your work.
Cool. Last send-off is, you know it and I know it, there's more in us. There's further places that we can go to live the life that we want to live. And to do that, we can learn from people that are extraordinary in their fields, and that they fundamentally create and structure their environment to get better. And so that is an incredible takeaway. And at a very macro level, the idea is that we want to stress our mind and our body and our spirit on a regular basis. And then we want to recover in world-class ways. So getting sleep right, getting nutrition on point, making sure that we're switching on our body and moving and lifting appropriately heavy things in the gym and getting our cardio systems right. And then we want to be optimal with our thinking. And those are the four pillars of recovery to become the best version of ourselves. So that's it. And I think that in a nutshell, what I've come to learn over the two decades of spending time with people that are extraordinary is that there is more in us, and that territory can be anxiety provoking. And as soon as we run to it, we become better at being comfortable in it. So that's my hope for people. And then the last piece, the send off is like findingmastery.net is a beautiful place to go to support and be connected to some of the ideas if they're of interest to people that have been listening so far. And social media is Instagram is at Finding Mastery. And then on Twitter is at Michael Gervais. That's G-E-R-V-A-I-S, as in Sam. And then if you want to check out what we're doing with Coach Carroll in that business, it's competetocreate.net.
Michael, thanks again for coming on, brother. Really do appreciate it. Take care, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thank you, Justin.
As always, if you haven't joined the Elite Man Mastermind group on Facebook yet, do yourself a big favor and get on that right now. Connect with thousands of guys just like you who are looking to improve themselves every single day. This is the best Facebook group on the planet, totally free, and this is going to push you, motivate you, inspire you, give you tips, advice, and strategies for helping you master the biggest challenges in your life. EliteManMastermind.com will take you right to the group on Facebook where you can join. It's a closed group, which means it might take a couple minutes, a couple hours for you to get accepted in by one of the moderators or myself, but I promise you, we will get you in if you're not a spammer and you don't have a creepy profile. So go to EliteManMastermind.com if you haven't yet. Join the group. You're going to absolutely love this and join a collection of thousands of amazing guys just like you who are looking to improve themselves and help you out along the way.
All right, guys, I hope you enjoyed that episode. But before you go, there's one last thing I need you to do. I need you to subscribe to this podcast right now if you haven't already. By subscribing to the podcast, you get every single episode the minute they're released. Get all of our Elite Man podcast interviews with all of our incredible world-class guests from the lifestyle, health, fitness, business, and social worlds absolutely free. Subscribe now, guys, if you haven't already, and enjoy all future episodes. And yes, if you do love the podcast, leave us an awesome review. We really do appreciate it.